In late 2009, Chicago resident Wes Denkov filed a class action lawsuit against the manufacturers of summer infant day and night baby video monitors. In the suit, Denkov said he had bought the monitor for his infant son's nursery. Then, about 6 months later, his neighbors, parents of newborn twins, noticed that they could see and hear video and audio from the Denkov's monitor. The suit claims that when the neighbors turned the channels, and there are only two on the product, they could sometimes observe all the conversation and activity within the Denkov's nursery. All conversation, not just when the baby was crying. This isn't too surprising, since the 47 to 49 megahertz range used by the baby monitor is accessible to most police scanners available from electronics stores. Given that, a police scanner within range could eavesdrop on all the baby scanners in the neighborhood. I talk about this more in my first book, When Gadgets Betray Us. Here, we have an example of a known default setting, the limited ability of transmitters to offer security being pushed down to inexpensive baby monitors. But the use of older, outdated technology in pricier mainstream gadgets? Well, it turns out it's pretty common. For instance, the early cordless telephones in homes in the 1980s and 1990s, they used a shared 2.5 megahertz, meaning that if your neighbors had a similar cordless phone, you could eavesdrop on their conversations. These were done out of convenience and cost. Sometimes similar things happen when you have a default password on TeamViewer account for a water treatment plant or any other ICS facility. It's the convenience of having anyone get on when they need to, but there's also a risk that's greater than a neighbor listening in on some conversation. Here, lives may be at stake. This is the story of how vulnerabilities in IoT and OT devices have an outsized kinetic effect in the real world, and how simple failures can multiply with catastrophic results. I'm Robert Vimosi. This is Error Code.
I am Dane Grace. I'm a senior product manager at Brinca. Brinca is a risk-based vulnerability management company. We produce a platform that aggregates data from multiple different risk management tools, as well as inventory management tools, and allows us to aggregate and consolidate that data so that customers can have a single sort of warehouse to see all of their risk-based data based on their environment.
So when I was pitched this interview, I was told that there were a lot of data points. Turns out, these are coming from all different sources.
This is entirely me being a cybersecurity and risk management nerd and reading a lot about it. I'm known as the, within Brinca, I'm known as the guy that says, or the person that says, your work matters and this is why. And then I just unload a torrent of horror stories of when vulnerabilities get popped and when organizations get breached and what that actually means.
The critical manufacturing sector in particular has seen a sharp rise in vulnerabilities. But I know there are 16 infrastructures, and I'm curious what horror stories Dane might bring to the conversation.
Dun, dun, dun. Healthcare, we're coming for you.
Well, as tempting as healthcare may be, let's start with critical manufacturing, because it's the one that doesn't get as much attention, in my opinion. I'm curious what Dane is seeing and what keeps him up at night.
So there are a couple of things. And I can be a bit long-winded about this. The fact of the matter is that, especially when it comes to operational technology, which is sort of, you know, in a manufacturing plant, it would be plasma arms or robotic arms. And you even look at industrial control systems. So, for example, CISA released something like several hundred advisories, ICS advisories last year alone around ICS. You look at these things and you begin to ask, one, why? I mean, the big thing is the why. Why are these things getting targeted? And from my research and my experience, there's really like two or three reasons. One, you have to look at the threat actors. And you have two main threat actors in that space. You have cyber criminals and you have nation state actors. It's interesting to cyber criminals because especially in the case of ransomware. They're really looking at being able to deploy ransomware or being able to take down these devices to extort money. And when, especially in the critical manufacturing sector, if you take down machines within a factory, you immediately begin affecting either productivity or safety, which are the forefront of their mind. So there, if you look at cyber criminals, especially from the profit incentive, if you lock down an email server, you could stand up a parallel server or you could find workarounds. If you lock down a factory floor, there is no real alternative factory floor or factory machines that you could stand up in short order. So you start really cranking on that profit incentive lever for the cyber criminals, and these things become great or really attractive targets for cyber. On the second half, you have nation state actors. US and Mexico, especially from the critical manufacturing perspective, and this is according to the Zscaler Threat Labs report from 2023, they saw the primary targets were Mexico and the United States. The United States and Mexico as an ally of the United States. The United States is, of course, the most dominant, for better or for worse, the most dominant kinetic military force on the planet. So for other nation state actors, you start looking at, or they start looking at asymmetric warfare. How can they attack with very little risk to themselves, at least physically, that will have incredible or at least powerful or outsized consequences for their adversary, in this case being us. If you look at the attack trends, taking down critical manufacturing, especially if they can attack military contractors, you start directly affecting the US military's ability to perform because you're picking up munitions and things like that. Or you could attack the mainland itself. And I believe it was the Nozomi report from last year that found that some of the most critically attacked sectors and the most actively attacked sectors were manufacturing and water and wastewater, followed by the energy sector. So if you start attacking energy, power, water, critical manufacturing sectors, you really start hindering, you really have these outsized consequences for their attacks with little to no, at least little to no direct kinetic impacts to themselves, right? And you can have one person attack multiple targets, right? So it's not that you're limited by boots in the ground. So you're looking at the, so you, if you take those motivations in from the cyber criminal side and the nation state actor side, and in certain adversaries, it becomes increasingly difficult to differentiate the cyber criminals from the nation state actions. They may not work, they may work on a more of a privateer basis or out of the love of country, but really they become sort of de facto nation state actors, at least by proxy. And so there you have these motivations from these two groups to attack these targets. In addition to the fact that IoT, OT, ICS devices are relatively soft targets compared to what we would call traditional IT assets, which really computers, right? With operating systems. And the majority of security has focused on the tooling to protect assets with operating, essentially computers. So if you look at the defensive tool set, you can bury an environment in security tools, but with IoT OT devices, these sort of operate on a very thin line operating system that may not be able to necessarily support onboard defensive tooling. And you're looking at packet monitoring and things like that. And so these things are relatively less defended than traditional IT assets. In addition, I honestly do not believe that a majority of these manufacturers are building with security in mind. And you see this in both the Nozomi report and the Zscaler report. And I've just started digging through Dragos's report, where there was something like a 30% increase in vulnerabilities found on these IoT OT ICS devices. And I think it was a Zscaler report of 39 vulnerabilities that they saw most exploited. Five of those were legacy vulnerabilities, and one of them dated back to 2013. So it's not only is the rate of discovered vulnerabilities increasing, but there are seemingly some very persistent older vulnerabilities that are still getting introduced into these devices. So you look at soft targets, you look at their motivation, the outsized impact, the profit incentive, and these become very, very attractive targets. And a lot of computer science classes that deal a lot with operating systems and traditional computing devices, a lot of the education for computer science and even maybe even cybersecurity doesn't directly relate to these things. So there, I think there's also a sort of like nascent skill gap in there that is sort of just lingering in the background.
I do know from past experience that finding vulnerabilities is one thing. Exploiting them, that's another. So just because you're discovering a lot of vulnerabilities in, say, a PLC or some low-level device, doesn't mean that you don't have security controls or other mitigations available.
There are absolutely mitigations and things like that. And to be clear, a lot of times, so I was looking at the Nozomi report yesterday, but one of the most seen attacks was passwords being transmitted over the wire in clear text. Then you also have things, another one of the more popular attacks was hard-coded admin passwords and things like admin, right? Or sysadmin, something like that. And so, yeah, there are security controls, but if the attacker breaches the network writ large and they pivot to one of those devices, there's either a relatively good chance they're going to capture a hard-coded password, or they know that that class of device, after they fingerprint it, has that hard-coded password. And once they're in, they look like an insider. They look like an IT admin, right? And so it becomes almost an insider threat scenario versus these are indicators of malicious activity. And so this is a multi-layered approach. And as we've all seen, the attackers are very good at deception, very good at deception.
So these are most likely chaining attacks. Once they get on the network, they're not looking for the crown jewels. Maybe they're looking to get a device so that they can shut it down, then extort the value.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, one of the most popular attacks is actually infecting IoT, OT, ICS devices with bot malware. And what they'll do is they'll internally DDoS the network and basically try to take down those devices via network attack. Pretty much flood TCP flood them to the point that they become unresponsive. Again, these aren't running our traditional operating systems that necessarily run firewalls where they can start filtering that stuff out. These are thin, very thin operating systems meant to basically run the commands that they're built to run, but they're still network connected and they still have TCP ports. So overwhelming these is often difficult, right? And being on the defensive tool side, I've seen it where there are things where we would have to turn off automation, automated remediations, or things like that, or automatically pinging the devices because if we weren't careful, we could actually knock the device offline because it wasn't meant to handle the amount of traffic that we would deliver via traditional scanning or traditional methods like that.
So there are two groups here. There's the legacy devices that were never built to handle this type of stuff, never thought it would be a scenario that they would have to entertain. And then there are the newer devices that have a lot more compute power. How's that working out? Is that commingling contributing to the overall problem?
I mean, I think so. What, especially from a bot perspective, you basically have a more powerful botnet now. But like I said, in Nozomi reported that the number of vulnerabilities that they found in their data was up 19% since 2023. So, are they better? Possibly. Is it good? I think the jury's kind of in on that, and that we're seeing the increase in vulnerability showing that these newer devices are vulnerable. One caveat, though, is that begets the question is this getting enough attention that researchers are starting to look into it and they're starting to reveal the vulnerability? But then again, that's not exactly great news that, oh, we started looking and it's bad, right? That's no comfort whatsoever. Can you tell I love this stuff? We have the coolest jobs in the world.
You mean always telling people what's wrong with their OT and IoT devices?
Well, I mean, it fundamentally matters. You know what I mean?
Yes, fundamentally, it does matter. And that's why I started this podcast. Okay, so this increased attention, it's good or bad? In other words, we've known these things were out there for years, and it's been kind of a quiet secret that we've all entertained, because we've always thought, well, they're not accessible. ICS, who's going to go after that? And then there's like this combination of researchers making it more apparent, or are there like nation states that are targeting them in particular and making them more susceptible?
I think, okay, these things have been targeted for at least a decade. And you can search news articles and you can find articles of attackers doing things of breaching baby monitors and sending creepy messages to babies while they sleep, right? I think it's multifactorial. One, I think the military started taking the cyber domain more seriously, which was sort of help raise public awareness. And frankly, I think CISA has had a huge hand in levering the attention up. Where there was this, for better or for worse, there was this governmental certification that these things matter and everybody needs to start looking at this. And by default, that it was sort of a butterfly effect in that several very prominent agencies began to raise awareness about this, and there's a butterfly effect of you had defensive tooling coming up, Nozomi, Dragos, Zscaler really started looking at these things and publishing their findings. So there's a profit incentive on the defensive side, right? Which then began generating interest. Now, I am sure there were plenty of researchers looking at this and screaming into the void about how vulnerable these things were. But to a certain degree, and this is maybe to our, and by our, I mean humanity's enduring shame, they may have been somewhat ignored, or yeah, we know it's bad. Hackers, etc., bad, but what does that really mean? I think there was also this tacit assumption that these factories were air gapped. They weren't reachable from the network. And I think one of the biggest shots across the bow that I heard was about 5 years ago, a water treatment plant in Florida. So there was this water treatment engineer working one night, remoted in, it was during the pandemic, remoted into the water treatment plant, working away, takes his hand off the keyboard, looks back, and his mouse moves. And he knows it wasn't him.
So it's really interesting to hear Dane talk about Oldsmar. What he says is factually correct.
And so he thinks, that's weird, and he begins ringing alarms. Turns out there was an attacker on the water treatment plant systems that was slowly raising the lye levels in the water for this small district in Florida. So they take everything offline and they started doing the incident response, and they found that there was an instance of TeamViewer that they were no longer using, that was sitting there on the network with default admin creds, and everybody in the plant was using the same login and password.
As I said, it's interesting to hear Dane talk about Oldsmar, because there's been some recent information about that event. Just last year, the FBI ultimately concluded that it wasn't an outside attack, that it was an inside engineer just tinkering around.
Okay, we were lucky it was an insider attack. If it was a very malicious nation-state actor just probing the environment, they got meaningful access. So I think that these things have always existed. Again, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we saw these sort of breaches and attacks, and people talking about how insecure these devices were, or how they just weren't being addressed or mitigated or properly segregated. I think we're closing the attention gap is the real deal. That entry point via traditional IT into the control system for that water plant was pretty illustrative of that chain of attacks and how it happened. But I think more so it was a very stark and very very bright indication that these things are being targeted by relatively unsophisticated attack techniques, and they're effective. And for me, at least that's when my awareness got shined on it of their actual kinetic effect. Everything falling out of that, I've just seen this massive increase in velocity in terms of attention and effort put into these types of devices.
My next question then is, are there models out there like the Purdue model and Bowtie and others that talk about air gaps that try to isolate the OT systems as much as possible from the network and the internet? Are these models becoming obsolete, or do they need to be simply tweaked and revisited?
Can I give you my nuclear hot take on critical infrastructure? And I've written this in an article. I think there should be essentially a US intranet on which all critical infrastructure goes on that is completely and totally and physically air-gapped and segregated from the public internet. I also think there should be severe fines and severe regulate pretty severe consequences if you put critical infrastructure on the public internet. I understand that's a huge infrastructure project. I understand that that would be a huge burden, but the reality of the matter is the fact that the same network that hosts defibrillators and water treatment plants is the same network that TikTok lives in is complete insanity.
Okay, I do agree. That would be a huge Manhattan project to make sure that there was a secure enough network for cybersecurity. So I've talked to some people in the energy sector, and they've quietly assured me that the scenarios that we see in the movies of power grids going down for, say, all of Southern California are unlikely. In part because it's really a grid of grid of grids, and it goes down to even the neighborhood level. So to find a way to bring all of them down at once seems unlikely. And they also point out to the Purdue model. This has never happened because you can't get down to those individual devices. I'm wondering what Dane's take is on the security that's interwoven in that way. Does that make sense, or does that seem like a lame response?
These are somewhat off the cuff. One, they don't have to take down all of them. They have to take down a part of a major metropolitan network. I mean, so you live in Northern California. I live in Southern California. We have some of the most densest population centers in the country, if not the world. How many would you have to take down before you're affecting hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people? Or if there was a major hospital, say an oncology ward in one of those sections to take it down. Two, there's that whole adage of open source and cryptography where you can only design systems that someone as smart as you couldn't compromise. But what happens when there's someone smarter or more determined than you? Right? All of these models are given current data and current understanding, but how many times have Stuxnet, that Iranian power plant, was supposed to be what's completely air-gapped and supposed to be inaccessible to the outside world? Stuxnet had other things to say about it, and a pretty sophisticated military campaign found its way in. Okay. So what happens if nation-state actors, I mean, this gets into insider threat, right? What happens if nation state actors get insiders or, start turning people, right? That's one thing. The other half of it is there was that malware that attacked a chemical plant. I think it was in Abu Dhabi.
What Dane is referring to is one of the Triton attacks. In 2017, FireEye, now Mandiant, disclosed an attack where malicious actors used the Triton custom attack framework to manipulate industrial safety systems at a critical infrastructure facility and inadvertently caused a process shutdown.
And it was targeting the emergency control system, where if they took it down, they could have caused the plant to basically explode or at least leak toxic chemicals. I think there is a fallacy of all or nothing, and really a cluster of smaller attacks or a cluster of smaller outages could have outsized kinetic responses. And so you get into the question of acceptable risk, and it becomes this grim calculus of how many people are we willing to have out of power for a period of time, or how many hospitals to be out of power or running on generators for a period of time at limited capacity that has an oncology and a neonatal ward. And I know there's no such thing as perfect security, right? But I don't know. Yeah, it could be difficult to take the whole thing down and to have, the movie apocalypse happen, but it doesn't have to be the movie. I guess my response is it doesn't have to be the movie apocalypse. It could be a very scaled down version of that and still affect a ton of people. And it's all fun and games until it's where you live, until it's the hospital that serves your community, right? They took down Maryland or Northern Virginia. I bet you that would get a lot of attention.
In some ways, what Dane suggests is actually more scary because it's nuanced and it would probably escape notice.
100%. And I get the sense too that it's the terrorism effect, right? Is the actual kinetic damage that devastating? Is it, Dresden? No. But if you start planting those seeds of fear, uncertainty, and doubt and vulnerability, I'm not saying that you would unravel society, but you could shake a culture pretty readily, in my opinion. And we've seen it.
In other discussions I've had, I'm considering, say, Europe, Estonia, for example, where you could take down their internet and you pretty much take down the entire country, all their services, everything just goes away. The United States, it's not Estonia, and it would probably be much harder to cripple, but I think Danes addressed it a little bit in that it would be much more nuanced in its attack on the United States in order to achieve the kinetic results.
How many payment processors would you have to take down to really start hampering the economy? Would be my response to that. You look at nation state motivations, right? What I think doesn't get talked about, because we've seen these one-off attacks of single threat groups attacking a single entity. What if you had sort of an APT-38 or some sort of nation state backed threat group or collection of threat groups that acted in concert to attack several key targets at the same time? And really they in a coordinated fashion, they were to take down multiple payment processors, right? And we know there's a bit of a bottleneck there. You can talk about why. But really to be able to hamper the ability to process transactions, and so you start taking down old chains and grocery stores or their ability to affect payment at least electronically, and people show up to the store with only the plastic or Apple Pay or Google Pay, and they're said, sorry, come back with cash. And then you look at the sort of butterfly effect from that. Well, I mean, how much damage could that do? In terms of, let's just talk about pure dollar amounts, right? That could have severe economic impact.
So there isn't just attacking the IoT devices. There is finance, for example, which is number one in the critical infrastructures. So of the 16, we've covered maybe like four or five. Are there some other industries that come up in Dane's research?
Obviously, healthcare, and we've seen malware on defibrillators, like botnets on defibrillators and medical devices. Frankly, and I hate to put this out in the world, but I think it's already out in the world. So, hospitals seem to be soft targets, and their IT teams seem to be relatively lean and perhaps under-resourced. And a number of devices that you and I would say, why is that connected to the internet? Are connected to the internet. And there have been multiple reports where a number of hospitals, their networks were flat. For those who are uninitiated, a flat network means you can segregate networks into sort of virtual subnetworks. I'm trying to say this in layman's terms. So that the only thing on this network are medical devices, defibrillators, heart rate monitors, that sort of thing. And then over here is the guest Wi-Fi for the hospital. And over here is the network where HR and human resources lives. And here are the over in this subnetwork is where the doctors can enter their notes and things like that. A flatware network means everything is all on the same network, right? So the same place that the doctor goes to look up medical journals to on the public internet, having to log in and all that, but look at medical articles to better treat their patients is the same network that the defibrillator, heart rate monitor, and possibly like medical dispense automated medical dispenser lives. Meaning that if attacker gets on that network, they can see everything. They don't have to traverse to a subnetwork. If they get in, if someone clicks a phishing email over here and gets their device compromised, that device can go over there and see that medical device of some sort, right? And again, a lot of these are IoT OT devices. They're running thin line operating systems that don't necessarily maybe have a firewall or EDR or something like that, or they don't have a traditional scanner to search for vulnerabilities. They would have to buy a specialty IoT OT product in order to see the vulnerabilities or risk facing that product. And they fingerprint it, they see the device, they go search it. There may be a Metasploit module, or in the dark web, there may be some 0 days that no one's seen, and they go take over that device. Now they now have the defibrillator. Now, they may not be trying to take down that heart rate monitor or that defibrillator, but they turn it into a botnet, which knocks that device off as it starts flooding traffic, knocks all those devices off the network, and now they're down to cuffs and manual devices to be able to treat patients. And so healthcare is seemingly a very soft target with, again, an outsized kinetic impact. Healthcare comes to mind often. And to be honest, like,
Again, it's the convenience of it. Always the trade-off with security or convenience. So I'm wondering if Dane could drill down a little bit and talk about what a botnet being on the defibrillator would look like.
so unless you're monitoring your network traffic, you may not know it's doing it. But what it is a small piece of malware, computer virus, however you want to state that, that would connect to a command and control server, so that it would, through the internet, connect to external computer system, and the command and control server could say, "Hey, send packets, TCP packets, to this target." Now, what that means for the defibrillator is now having to waste processor cycles and network load, not on, hey, does this person's heart need a little shock to correct that arrhythmia? It is now wasting processor cycles, and these things are pretty thin. They don't have a lot of compute power. Is spending that time to do the calculations to send it a TCP packet to an external target to try to take down a website or take down a web server or something like that. And it could knock that defibrillator online, offline, where that defibrillator became unresponsive. And so it can't send those little jolts to fix that arrhythmia because it's at 100% computing capacity trying to send a flood of packets to a victim at the behest of a malicious actor.
So, in essence, there's like two DDoS attacks going on. There's the target that's being DDoSed, but then there's also a denial of service on the actual medical device itself.
So here's the other one. To your point about the DDoSes, right? You could have you let's say that a cyber criminal, and this is somewhat theoretical, but I think this could play on the real world. Cyber criminal wants to ransom, extort a manufacturer of consumer medical devices, right? And by consumer, I mean prescribed by the doctor, defibrillator, heart rate monitor, blood glucose monitor, something like that, right?
Right.
And those are pinging back to the manufacturer. So, and we know that especially ransom as a service operators work this way, where they will thoroughly breach the network, get as many ma man, as much data as possible, and really learn a network so that they can be better extortion artists. I could see a world in which they start finding the IPs or the locations of all these devices and begin trying to distribute those that malware to as many devices as they can, and use that as a lever in the extortion tactics of, hey, pay us our money, or we will tell N number of devices to start a DDoS attack on whomever we want, maybe on you. And not only will we DDoS your website, but we'll do our best to knock a bunch of these medical devices offline for your customers. I mean, we saw that with the Microsoft hack of when the actor breached their emails. They were in there for a quarter. They were in there for 3 months. If you have a team of five people who have nothing to do but find a way to wreak the most destruction, that doesn't seem so out of the realms of possibility. And hopefully I didn't give anyone ideas.
I feel that way too. Just talking about these, sometimes people look at me and they're like, why are you even talking about this stuff? You're just giving people ideas. And it's like, no, these ideas, they're already out there. And so you need to hear these as well.
It's you and me riffing on what we've already seen and researched.
So we've talked a lot about IoT in the manufacturing and industrial spaces. There's also the whole consumer side as well. And here, health. It crosses over with home devices.
Consumer devices concern me a lot because those are all botnets, massive botnets waiting to happen. If someone has a houseful of consumer IoT devices, that's light bulbs, set-top boxes, entertainment centers, voice-controlled light switches, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you multiply that by the number of homes in either in the US or across the world. That is a massive and possibly, world-ending botnet that could flood incredible amounts of traffic to attack targets, right? You could see it try to take down the NHS systems or things or things like that, right? So, healthcare and honestly consumer devices, because for good reasons, a lot of consumers aren't really thinking about the security of their internet connected light bulb. I mean, to be clear, some of these IoT devices have orders of magnitude more computing power than some of the Apollo missions, to put that into context. Like, we sent things to space with less computing power than your baby monitor or something like that.
I want to thank Dane Grace for talking about some of the broader threats affecting IoT and OT systems today. And I agree with him. It is the more nuanced attacks that we need to be focused on. It's not the, let's take out the entire East Coast power grid. It's more like, what about the hospitals? What about the businesses that are critical to running this country that are in certain areas that could be targeted and taken down? Hey, if you're enjoying Error Code, tell a friend. I'm sure there are other people out there who like narrative information security podcasts. And I'd really like to hear from you. Join us on Discord. Search for Error Code Podcast to join the server, or go to errorcodepodcast.com to get more details. And tell me what you like, and even what you don't. Hey, I've got some great episodes coming up, including more on quantum computing, and why we need to secure ICS SCADA systems in the cloud. Subscribe today. I don't want you to miss out.